For the week of April 12th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 489, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Stamford, Connecticut, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in Stamford, Connecticut now?
Well, we're putting in a bid for the XFL. Vince McMahon's football league just announced they are out of business.
You know who else is out of business, by the way? Yeah, everyone is going out of business.
They had furloughed people. They had said the season was going to end. And now a few days later, they said, we're not going to be able to make it. It's a new business. And as a new business, they don't have any cushion. So they were doing okay. They were doing all right. The season had just begun, just like the XFL back in 2001. They lasted one season. This one is going to last part of a season. It's a shame. It might have actually worked. You never know, but we'll never know because the virus has thrown it all into disarray. So yeah, they are done. XFL is over. We could pick it up and maybe use that trademark. We could be Showbiz Sandbox XFL.
Yeah, I don't know that we really need that. But, you know, AMC theaters here in the U.S., largest movie theater chain in the world, they are not only a year old. And there are rumors that they might file for bankruptcy because of their debt load.
Well, lots of the theater chains are piling on some debt to deal with this crisis. But AMC already had a lot of debt, didn't they?
Well, yes, because they did $2 billion deals, and that's billion with a B. About 2 or 3 years ago, in the span of 18 months, they bought both Carmike Cinemas here in the U.S., and then they went overseas and bought Odeon Cinemas in the EU. Those were both billion-dollar deals, so that's $2 billion worth of leveraged debt right there.
And so when you're vulnerable and you don't have a cushion, it's not a good time for a recession.
Or, you know, having to shut your business entirely, earning exactly $0 in revenue.
For weeks and months to come.
Correct.
But we, however, operate rent-free and money-free. So we've never had a cushion and we never need one. So Showbiz Sandbox continues. Obviously, episode 500 will probably take place in a shutdown. 11 episodes from now, the world will not be back to normal. What a bummer. But nonetheless, the show will go on. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are insisting that the show must go on, Michael. Yes, it's got to go on, but we are insisting that it go on.
Yes.
And no one knows that better than Broadway. Yes, the Broadway community knows that the current season is over, okay? But they're looking towards the future. To help us do that, we'll be joined by the Tony-winning theater producer, podcaster, videocaster, and all-around cheerleader of the industry, Ken Davenport. He'll tell us how he's keeping the spotlight shining on showbiz and why he thinks the pandemic will reshape the way they do business. We'll also look at some of the latest news from the pandemic, including some bad news for the Cannes Film Festival. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss a few of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's, I can't believe I'm about to say this again, the video on demand charts.
Well, hey, that's not some sort of sad little afterthought. I covered DVD and Blu-ray for years. VOD is a big market. There's some billions of dollars being made there, I'm sure. And for the week of March 30th through April 5th, we have a list of the 10 most popular titles. These are all new releases, except for one. They're all, you know, movies that have been around recently, and people are renting them. How much are they normally paying to rent a movie for a video on demand?
Well, it's anywhere between $2.99 for standard def, all the way through, you know, $19.99 for premium VOD.
But rare premium VOD is very rare. Typically, it's $2.99 to like $4 or $5.99.
Correct. Yes.
To rent a movie. That's right.
To rent. Yes.
All right. But right now we have that next week is when we'll be seeing what happens with Trolls World Tour, that we have some early information in Big Deal or Big Whoop. But there's one new movie and it's at the top of the charts. It's Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. That is the most popular movie on video on demand 2 weeks ago. Not this last week, but the week before. And in fact, Star Wars will pop up again in our obituaries. All the other films on our chart are the same. They may be in slightly different order, but you're not seeing a lot of moving around or new titles coming crowding into here. I would have thought maybe there'd be some accelerated releases or some new movies would come or people would discover new stuff, but I guess kind of like the movie charts, they stay pretty static week to week. So number
one—
Are
you saying you killed Star Wars? I don't understand. You said Star Wars—
It will appear in the obituary. It will be referenced in our obituary section. In our most popular titles on VOD, we don't know how much they're grossing, but we do know what's the most popular? Number one is Star Wars Episode 9. Number two is 1917, the World War I epic film. Terrific movie. And number three is Jumanji, The Next Level, a family-friendly flick. And number four is Just Mercy. And number five is Knives Out, the Agatha Christie homage. And number six is the one film on our list that is not from 2019, or actually they're all from 2019. Not one is from 2020 yet. At number six is Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film. Some black humor going on there for people watching that. At number seven, Ford versus Ferrari, then Bombshell, then Frozen 2, and finally Spies in Disguise. As you pointed out last week, Frozen 2 probably would have been higher up on the list, except it's available for free if you subscribe to Disney Plus. That too has proven very, very popular. And here's something I didn't know. The VOD split, you know, when a movie goes to theaters, usually the studio gets 50% or 55% or maybe even higher if it's a really big movie in Disney. In video on demand, the split for the studios and the people who put it out there is 80-20.
Oh, yeah. That's why they like VOD.
Exactly. And they made a lot off of DVD as well. I wonder what the split was there.
It depended on whether it was priced for rental or priced for sale.
Well, sale.
Yeah.
Well, sale.
I don't know necessarily.
The rule of thumb was you would double the price when you put it in a store, right?
Right, exactly.
So maybe they sold it to the store for $12 and the store would sell it for $25. So that would mean about a 50-50 split there as well. But that's where video demand is, and that's where a lot of the news is in our coronavirus update. That's the one area where things are happening, aren't they?
That's true. I mean, I don't know where you want to start. I mean, certainly Disney Plus has hit 50 million worldwide paid subscribers, but I guess my question is, really? 50 million worldwide? They launched in France 2 weeks late.
Not enough or too much? What do you mean?
No. I just wonder, is it really? Because I know that Verizon was giving it away for a while. There were all these like early subscriber incentives. And I'm wondering if those are lopped into
There are 8 million of them have an asterisk by them. Then the new total includes 8 million involved in India with some giveaway as well. So they were saying it's paid, but it was unclear if that meant they were locked in paid. So there's definitely some wiggle room in there. It's still a very impressive number. They're not obfuscating the fact that some of those people have been signed up for free, but then if they stay on, that they will be there. But it's not being given away to 50 million people. A lot of people, tens of millions of people, have signed up and are paying the $6 a month for Disney Plus. Some of the new total does include people in India who are piggybacking on some other service they're paying for. So we'll find how that shakes up down the road. And we're certainly going to see what happens when HBO Max comes online. The Peacock ad-supported one is coming online, and HBO Max will still come out in May, they say. We thought perhaps they would delay the release date for that, but of course, you know, Warner Brothers has such a big library, it's not going to look thin no matter how, you know, many of the new shows are sort of blocked from day one. They won't have their Friends special, but they will have Friends, for example.
So, and I'm just now speaking of video on demand. Mm-hmm. Literally, as I'm sitting here, I am getting an email from, it's a press release from Lionsgate. They are teaming up with Fandango, YouTube, and
Nader.
Yeah,
I saw that, yeah.
To help furloughed movie theater employees across America. They're going to be streaming 4 movies, 1 per Friday, across 4 weeks. The Hunger Games, Dirty Dancing, La La Land, and John Wick. How are they supporting?
Well, some of the profits will go to help, you know. But of course, if you really want to support your employees, support a $15 national minimum wage pegged to inflation. Other movie that's coming to streaming, of course, is My Spy. That film was going to come into theaters, and just like Trolls World Tour, and what's some of the other movies that are coming straight? Next week is, last week was something else.
Well, Emma, kind of, you know,
films. Emma had played in theaters. My Spy has not played in North America. It's going straight to streaming in North America. It's skipping
the Lovebirds went straight to Netflix, and that was a Paramount film with Camille Nanjiani and Issa Rae.
And this one makes sense because it's a family-friendly film. It will rent well. I'm not sure how many people want to pay $20 for it, but we'll find out.
Those two films, the thinking there is that the money to market them was already spent. They already spent that money to market those movies. They didn't want to have to spend it again to relaunch a marketing campaign around those films.
That made sense. And of course, people are stuck at home. They're not going to Disney World. And there was an announcement that Disney World in Florida is furloughing officially 43,000 workers. I don't know if they were paying them right up to this week or what was going on, but now they are officially furloughed. So that's a big hit to the unemployment numbers as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I thought you were going down a different road there to talk about HBO Max, which is still launching in May.
We did. We talked about them.
Okay. Well, you know, you mentioned that? Okay. I guess yeah. I was so busy looking at the email that had just come in from Lionsgate that I didn't even hear that.
That came in a while ago. And so the segue was going to be, hey, people aren't going to Disney World. And you know what? They're also not going to Con.
Yes, and I have to thank CJ Flynn for this. He alerted me immediately as soon as Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, said, hey, you know what? Actually, we're going to extend our stay-at-home directives to May 11th, and we're going to slowly begin to lift them. But you know what? As far as large gatherings and concerts and festivals are concerned, you know, we're not going to lift that until probably mid-July, which, by the way,
at the earliest.
Yeah. And that puts two events in jeopardy. One is the Cannes Film Festival, the other being the Tour de France. We're talking about the Cannes Film Festival, however. Part of the problem there is they can't go back and do the festival in the summer because Cannes is a summer vacation town.
Well, things aren't available and other events are booked anyway. There's advertising festivals and it's not like it sits empty.
Well, the advertising festival already moved.
Well, no, I'm just saying there are all sorts of things booked at Cannes. So you can't just say, oh, well, we'll take that date. Well, there are other things happening there. So yeah, the film festival doesn't have its pick of dates, you know? It's a very busy venue that gets booked all year long, surely.
Yes, well, there's MIPCOM, which was canceled this year. Mm-hmm. MIP TV as well, canceled this year. And as soon as the Cannes Lion, that advertising, I don't want to say it's a festival, it's an advertising event where, you know, they give awards out for some of the best ads around throughout the world. They are usually in the third and fourth week of June. They immediately moved way back in March and Cannes said, okay, we'll take that slot. Well, now, of course,
that's out.
The country is saying, yeah, no, you can take that slot, but you won't be allowed to actually hold the event.
Right. And of course, then there are other festivals, you know, you've got all the other, you know, late summer and fall festivals that they would compete with. They can't pick those dates because those festivals already have their flag planted. So it's a bad time. It looks like Cannes will be off for this year. I imagine they can't hold it in the fall.
No, would you say, look, here's the films that we would have selected.
No, no, because that would be dissing the filmmakers you wouldn't select unnecessarily. There'd be no advantage to that whatsoever.
Well, there might be an advantage for the films that were selected.
I don't think so. I don't think there would be any reason to do that. And they haven't been able to see them properly. The films haven't been finished properly. They haven't been able to finish their shooting. They haven't been able to offer up, you know. So no, yeah. I can't see any reason to do that. That would just be ugly. So it's a bummer for Cannes. But there is some good news on the horizon, isn't there?
What good news are you talking about? I have no idea at this point.
Well, in China, just a week ago, China claimed no new deaths on April 6th for the first time in 3 months. I don't know how that has held up in the days since then. It's been, you know, it's been almost a week. We're recording on April 13th. But that was certainly a good idea that they might be turning the corner and putting it in their rearview mirror. So that's certainly good to hear. But we do know that it's going to be a long time getting out of this. It's impacting every part of the industry very strongly. We've been speaking to a couple people to talk about the film industry. A few weeks ago, we covered the theater industry. Now we're going to tackle that again, aren't we?
Well, Michael, I know we've been going over, you know, beat by beat or industry by industry. We've been kind of covering how the pandemic is affecting, whether it's movies or books or television or music. And we did theater a couple of weeks ago, but now we're going to do theater again because, you know, just this past week, the shutdown of Broadway, which is already unprecedented, has been extended until June 7th. And so now we're going to be joined by Ken Davenport, who is one of Broadway's most visible producers. He produces shows both on Broadway and, of course, off-Broadway. He's won the Tony for Best Revival of a Musical. He's delivered hits that ran for ages, like the Christian boy band hit Altar Boys. And that's just the start. I mean, it's kind of hard to capture Ken's resume. He also blogs about his love for theater and the challenges of the business, and he delivers a podcast. And he's been hosting live video chats during the pandemic shutdown with stars and behind-the-scenes legends like Tony winner William Ivy Long. And just on Easter Sunday, he reunited from the cast from his Broadway revival of Godspell to deliver a new performance of the shows. That's something you don't see every day by day. You get it, Michael?
Keep
day
going,
by
keep
day.
Going.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you for joining us. And when do you sleep, actually? That's what I want to know.
Unfortunately, I sleep more than I'd like. I keep saying I wish I'd come up with a lot of shows and even some websites and things and a board game in my career. I wish I could come up with something that would just allow me to sleep a little less, because there's a lot on my list I'd still like to do at the end of the day.
Well, there's a lot of stuff on your resume. Some of the shows you've been associated with include, of course, the Tony winner Once on This Island, Groundhog Day. You've been involved in Kinky Boots and the Bridges of Madison County, The Play That Goes Wrong, of course, that revival of Godspell, which was at Circle in the Square, I believe. Of course, your passion project, getting the band back together, a really tremendous revival of Spring Awakening, which I thought, well, that's too soon. And it was done by Def West from the West. And I thought, well, it's just barely ended a few weeks ago. And then I saw it and I was like, oh, wow, that was great. And of course, Off-Broadway, you had some huge hits, the awesome 80s Prom, which ran for a decade, Altar Boys, and you've got your podcast and blog, The Producer's Perspective. You've got a lot of stuff on your resume. It's very nice to talk to you. How are you coping? You're doing okay. You're sleeping too much. How is your Facebook video chats going? People who can go to Facebook, we'll have a link in our show notes, will find that every night you've been chatting with theater luminaries. And that's preserved there. People can play the video anytime, or they can watch them live and chat alongside everybody else. Is that helping keep you sane and unite the theater community?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Look, I am a creator and a producer, and my hands can't be idle very long. So I always have to be making something. And it wasn't too long that I was like, I need to make something if I'm going to be shut inside my apartment. And what I found out, it was like most things that I've done in my life that have been successful, it was totally organic. I literally started texting a few of my friends, and I'm very fortunate enough to have some very successful people as my friends from this industry. And I would say, like, how you doing? And then they would say something that would cheer me up, inspire me, get me to keep going. And I was like, more people need to hear this stuff, because these people are helping me. And I bet if I hosted this chat and let the public tune in, that they'd be inspired to keep going with their projects, whatever they're doing, whether it's theater or not, frankly, and just try to put a smile and joy on people's faces and let people know that we're all in this together. So I emailed a whole bunch of these theater luminaries, as you say, and these industry greats, and said, what do you think? You want to do this? I was overwhelmed by the response. So yeah, every single night at 8 o'clock Eastern on my Facebook page, we stream a live interview. It's about 30 minutes long. It's just me checking in with some big star and then them telling us how they're getting through it, what they're doing. And it's been a lot of fun, inspirational and motivational at the same time.
Well, now, you know, we often hear from people that listen to the show. We have people from all over the world listen to the show, and they say, well, gee, you're talking about Broadway again. That's only in New York. And I must say, this past weekend, I traveled to London, and I know that sounds kind of unusual during this time frame, but I did it from my couch. I watched Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar on YouTube, which is streaming on YouTube. It was an arena production that toured the world. This is a West End production, a Broadway show that is several decades old that they then did an arena tour of. It traveled all over the world. And indeed, the Def West production of Spring Awakening, I don't know whether it premiered here in Los Angeles, but I know that it was here in Los Angeles. Were you a part of that when it was being done?
I actually was, I spotted it there. So I knew about it. I had done a little bit of counsel for it and some consulting for it, because I do a lot of that. And then I went to see it because, frankly, I was like, oh, I've done some consulting on this. Let me go check it out and see what they're stirring up. Because I, like you, was like, it's too soon. And I saw it, and within 15 seconds, I knew it had to be on Broadway, and I was going to start moving it there.
So when you see something like that and you say, wow, this is really good. I'm in an old post office in Los Angeles, which is where that production was put on. Of course, that post office has been transformed into a huge, lovely theater. But what are the steps to go from that's really cool to I'm bringing it to Broadway and actually opening it on Broadway?
Well, the first step is, frankly, what you said, although it has to be even more than just cool. It has to be a, oh my gosh, I must do this. I want more people to see this. More people must see this show. And it is this unrelenting passion to get it out in the world. And the second step is with that show, because it was all created, it was done, it was beautifully directed by Michael Arden, who also directed my Once on This Island. Mm-hmm. And it was packaged and ready to go. So all that I had to do in that case is I had to call a theater owner and say, I've got this thing. Do you have an opening? I'd love to bring this onto Broadway. That is the hardest thing for producers nowadays, or it was. We'll see what it's like next 6 months to a year. The hardest thing has been for us to get a theater. Because producing in Broadway has been so popular, it's been so hot that all the theaters have been booked sometimes years out. So the first call was get a theater. And then actually that was a real shot out of a cannon production. From that moment when I saw it to when our first performance on Broadway was only 83 days.
Wow.
I do not recommend anyone try that at home. It was quite something. And again, it was only because the show really just picked up and moved right to New York.
So you're saying 90 days is definitely, that's doable, and we should definitely shoot for 90 days, but 83, a little too short.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, 84 is even fine. No.
Okay, all right.
Practicality, you really want about 6 months, and it has to do not only with just getting the production ready, it of course has to do with marketing. You want that kind of 6 month ramp up to launch anything on Broadway. It takes a lot to move theatergoers here.
So you find a project you're passionate about, or you create it from scratch, you mount it somewhere so you can see what you got, and then you want to take it to Broadway and you find a house, you get it there. The next step, of course, is making sure you don't lose your shirt and the shirt of all the other investors. How the heck do you do that? Of course, keeping costs down, I guess, but first of all, you have to be passionate about it because it'd be crazy to do it otherwise, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I always say that producing a Broadway show, people think it's this mysterious, mythical type craft. And frankly, I'm a business owner. I'm a CEO of a startup, or I'm a founder of a startup, and I have a product, and my product is a show. And every time I do a show, it's like a new startup. And the number one thing, of course, that determines whether a show is a success or not is the number one thing that determines whether anything is a success or not. Do people want to use it, buy it, like it? Do they like it? And that's it. You keep costs down, and you have to market the F out of it, and you have to do all those things. But at the end of the day, it's all about the content. And is the content something that resonates with people and that they can, quote unquote, use right now? And that's it. It's actually not reviews that fuel Broadway ticket sales. It's word of mouth.
Damn it. I used to review. Damn it.
Yeah. That's why you don't anymore. There are a whole lot of people who aren't reviewing anymore because, frankly, they've cut a lot of those jobs.
Oh, yeah.
We don't care about them.
Well, now let me ask you this. As speaking, I'm asking for a friend, really, who may or may not have lots of Broadway tickets for shows that were supposed to open later in the year, maybe even a few that were supposed to open in, or at least be on Broadway in May. What's going to happen to all these productions? I mean, The Music Man was supposed to open later in the year. Is that still going to happen? Some shows like The Six, they're kind of questioning, can they go on after the pandemic is over? What is going to happen to all these productions?
Well, it's a little early to say. I am anticipating that all the shows that were about to open, we've seen a couple fall away already. Right, Beetlejuice is not going to come back, but then we knew that was most likely going to happen.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is canceled.
Right. Virginia Woolf stopped, Hangman stopped. So we've seen the early fallout from shows saying, you know what, forget it, I'm not coming back. I believe that, first of all, I do not believe we'll be back on June 7th.
No, that just means the current season is over, right? Broadway was just saying the current season is a wash. I don't think they were anticipating that they would begin performances on June 8th. Because obviously you know, concerts and people packed together in a Broadway house, those are some of the last things that are going to come back to normal. That could be the fall, if not later.
Yeah. So I believe that all of the shows that have not yet said they're not coming back, all the shows will come back. Their sets are in there. It takes $1 million or more to load in one of those sets. So what you're so deeply invested at this point, I don't believe any show that hasn't announced that they're going to close permanently as of today, I don't believe we'll see any more. I think all the shows that are loaded in at this point, we're going to open or in previews, will open again when the lights come back on. You raise an interesting point, though, about shows that were scheduled that may have to rehearse, et cetera. Listen, Music Man has Hugh Jackman in it, some thought.
That will happen.
I don't think there's any doubt that that sucker is going to happen. And anything for the fall, I think, will happen. The question really is not will those shows happen, is what will happen to our audience and how quickly will they come back. And it's not just the locals. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that 65% of our audience is made up of tourists outside the tri-state area.
And that's surely only in like the first year or two. After that, it's got to be much higher, doesn't it? Because you've exhausted all your locals come a year or two.
Yeah, so the 65 is probably the average tourist. But yeah, in the first chunk of time, it's locals, and then it bleeds out to the tourist market. And 18% of that 65% is international. So will we get an international audience flying to New York, which, as we know, has been ravaged by this sucker? I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I think it's going to depend a lot on how quickly the economy bounces back. It's going to depend a lot on the other mass gatherings. You know, I'm watching very closely what the professional sports organizations do, what concerts do. Like, I take my cues from some of these bigger industries. It's going to depend a lot on vaccines and all these things that will make people more comfortable getting back in the theater.
Well, I know that with certainly the movie theater industry, there is some talk about, well, when we go back in and we kind of relaunch the world, that there will be regulations, local regulations, that require there to be like 50% seating or every other seat to be sold. Has there been talk about that for Broadway as well?
There's been a lot of chatter about a lot of ways to do it. And you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens because I don't know that I'm such a fan of that because frankly, that it's a live experience and it's not a movie where the actors in that movie can see the audience and experience that thing. So I'm not sure I buy that. I'd rather actually wait a bit longer and make sure we can come back the way we're supposed to come back. But we'll see. I'm certainly open to all proposals.
Well, and you said June 7th is probably that you think it's going to go beyond that. There has been some talk that the reason that it's June 7th now and it hasn't been, you know, pushed out to July 15th or whatever is because of, you know, there are insurance reasons for that. There's ticketing reasons for that, that they don't want to get too far ahead of what government organizations are predicting or kind of ruling.
That's right. I mean, that, you know, it's this question of no one knows what is going to happen. Every time I come to a decision, frankly, 2 days later, something changes and I'm glad I didn't make it public. Like I've been trying to, with a lot of my businesses, with my shows and things, I've been saying, okay, I'm making this decision, but you know what? I'm going to sit on it for 48 hours because things are changing so rapidly. So I've been sitting on things, thankfully, and in 48 hours, I'm like, boy, I'm glad I didn't make that decision because things have changed. So you can't make too many decisions prematurely right now.
That's right. And I think if a lot of Broadway shows could only sell half their seats, they would be guaranteed to lose money at every performance. But anyway, do you have any current projects that you have put on hold or that you're not sure what you're going to do with? I mean, what were you in the midst of dealing with and you know, bringing to tour or bringing to, you know, a theater somewhere? You know, what was in your happening right now?
So thankfully, I didn't have anything in production on Broadway. I had the play That Goes Wrong, which was on Broadway, moved off Broadway, so that was halted. I had two national tours halted, so that hurt. And then the rest of my stuff was in development. So I have a bunch of musicals in development. A musical based on the National Lampoon Vacation franchise.
Right.
That got moved. So that was supposed to debut in Seattle in the fall. We're now going to the spring. A musical based on Joy, the life story of Joy Mangano, who was the subject of the movie Joy starring Jennifer Lawrence. That was going to be next spring, probably get shifted further out, because what happens is there were shows at that theater supposed to happen this fall. They're just getting bumped, right? Everything's getting bumped down the road. And then the big one for me is I'm doing a musical based on the life and music of Neil Diamond. And we're still figuring out what we're going to do with that. We had a plan in place, but it had not been announced at this point. And we're analyzing the situation to decide what we think is the best for the show, given everything we do not know at this time.
Sperling, who's our friend who works with Neil Diamond, the Rolling Stone guy who writes for the award shows?
David Wilde, you mean?
David Wilde, yeah. He's a good friend with Neil Diamond. I'm wondering how you landed that, because every major catalog, people are saying Elton John, the Stones, The Who, Bob Dylan. Neil Diamond is a huge catalog, one of the enduring artists. And I'm wondering how you landed him and convinced him, yes, let's do the show together, and B, how you decided at this stage to do a bio musical rather than, say, just a musical using his songs.
Well, I came to this, it was my producing partner who I met, that Bob Gaudio. So Bob Gaudio, one of the
Jersey Boys, yeah.
Jersey Boys, and he and Neil go way back, and Neil was a big Jersey Boys fan. So he mentioned it to Bob, and Bob and I connected, and we've hit it off, and that's how that partnership was started. We talked about the idea of a fictional story with his music, but Neil Diamond is a man that I don't think it's possible to separate from his music.
I cry. Yeah, exactly.
I said he's so iconic, and he's a Brooklyn boy. His songs, you can hear the man in the songs, you can see him, and I just don't think you can ever separate it, so why try?
Have you ever thought about doing a musical about, podcasters? Because we know some people the life rights of which could be very, very cheap.
But listen, if that's an offer, don't call me. I'll call you. Okay.
I feel like people who produce Broadway shows, you have a sort of a strength and resilience that's part of your DNA. Because like you say, unlike a local restaurant, they've got their fixed monthly costs. They've been there for years. Every new show is a new launch, like you say. So when we get back to live theater, perhaps independent producers like you are exactly where you always find yourself, facing the crazy task of trying to raise funds for a project you believe will buck the odds and become a financial and creative success. One new challenge, of course, is going to be that we're going to be in the midst of a recession, I guess. That's a new wrinkle you're going to have to tackle, isn't it?
It certainly is. And, you know, we've battled recessions before. And in the past, the theater has proven somewhat recession-proof, because people always need a chance to forget their troubles. I mean, that's why musical theater especially was created, so that people could go forget about the troubles of the world and lose themselves in entertainment for a few hours. Now, this recession is a little bit different because it's so global and it involves, again, gathering, right? It's that thing, social recession that could happen as well as an economic recession. So it's going to be interesting. But look, the theater, you know, people always say, they've been saying this since I got into the business, oh, the theater is dying, technology will kill it, like all these things. And my answer has always been, you know what? The theater has survived the invention of the radio, the television, the internet. Like, it is the most resilient art form I know, because it is so cumbersome, expensive, challenging to produce, yet it has been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It is a primitive human need to gather in groups and hear a story. And we may go through a little blip here, but in the long run, we will continue to be around and we will grow over the next decade. I have no doubt about it.
Now tell us about the challenge you set yourself. You wanted to launch 5,000 shows in the next 5 years by 2025. I wasn't sure if you meant 5,000 performances, which I thought was also crazy, but maybe you could do it. But did you mean literally 5,000 shows? And tell us what your idea was.
Well, listen, I'm a big believer in the BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goals. And I simply believe that the world is a better place if there's more theater in it. So I established a mission to try to help people create their own shows, produce their own shows, get new stuff out into the world, anything theatrical. So a couple years ago now, I got my team together and we've developed a whole bunch of tools to help people do this. And it started with my blog. Like I started writing my blog about producing and creating theater 11 years ago when their blogs weren't a thing. And I did it because it was the type of information that I always wanted to have as a theater maker when I was coming up, but didn't exist. So I wrote it hoping that people would find it and make some theater and I'd answer some questions. Well, that took off. The corresponding podcast took off. And then I developed in the last few years, a community called the Theater Makers Studio. It's just theatermakersstudio.com. And it's a community of people, huge community now, all based, it's all over the world, I should say. And it's all people that want to make theater at varying different degrees. Some professionals that have had stuff produced all over the place. Some people that just have an idea for a script. They want to get on a piece of paper and they don't know where to start. So we've put a lot of resources and it's like masterclass for the theater, honestly. There's a bunch of video tutorials and all sorts of resources. And this is the place. It's actually the only place. If you have an idea for the theater, musical play, even a screenplay, whatever it is, and you want to make it, this is the only place where you can get all the resources, a lot more. And we will guarantee that if you go through this program, you will come out with something to put up in front of people. And that's all it takes. It's the beginning. It's a beginning.
Now, is there a similar program for motion pictures or television that you're aware of?
Well, not specifically. I mean, we have a lot of screenwriters in our community because a lot of the principals, especially at the beginning phases, getting an idea on paper, the structure, like all those things, the script certification process of what we do, it's the same. It's the same. Like so many people walk around saying, oh, I have a great idea for a screenplay. I have a great idea for a screenplay, but they just never get it out on paper, partly because of fear and partly because they just don't know how to do it. You know, one of the things that we do is we have a 30-day script challenge. I think you can just Google Ken Davenport 30-day script challenge. It'll come up. And in 30 days, we guarantee you'll have a rough draft of a script. You'll have something. I'm not saying it's going to be a Pulitzer Prize winner, but you go through this thing in 30 days. It's totally free, by the way. And yes, if you just Google Ken Davenport 30-day script challenge, it'll come up. Go through it. You will have that idea that has been roaming around your brain for the last, some people for a decade. Go through this. You'll have it down on paper. And only when you get it down on paper can you do something else with it. And that's when the fun begins.
Well, you've been blogging about the industry since 2008, I believe, of course. And now you have your podcast as well. And during this pandemic, you've been saying, all right, there are some trends that have been going on, and I think they're going to accelerate because of this pandemic. And two things in particular that you pointed to were, one, theatergoers are not going to want to pay cash. No one wants to touch cash anymore. I assume most theater tickets were bought by credit card anyway. But the other one you pointed to was the move to paperless tickets. I thought that was interesting, and I was going to ask you, if we move to paperless tickets or it becomes a lot more common, do you think that will help fight scalping, and are we ready for paperless tickets?
I do believe paperless tickets are the way to go. I've been saying this for a long time. I do think that I do think it'll affect scalping. I've actually gone as far as to say, why aren't we like the airlines and just have photo ID for tickets? That would just
right exactly
right there. It has some problems with gifts and those kind of things, but there's got to be a way around it. So I'm all for that and I'm real supportive of it.
Yeah, you know, it seems like for gifts, if you buy someone a gift, either you know it when you buy it and you can put their name as the receiver of it, or if you need to transfer it to someone, you'd be able to do that once. And guess what? If you do it once, the theater will say, of course. If you buy 100 tickets to the show or you buy tickets every night for the next month, they're going to say, oh, wait, hold on a second. You're a scalper. You're not actually someone who's giving this as a gift. So it seems pretty simple that you could work a way around that. Well, we know your origin story is that you had this foolish dream of becoming a lawyer. And then you said, no, wait a second. I want to go to the arts. And you switched to arts. But did your love for theater begin even before that? Tell us about your first time, the first time you were on stage, perhaps in grade school or high school, or maybe just the first time you were in the audience and fell in love with theater.
Well, my mother tells me that I first kicked when she was watching a performance of Godspell. So there was a production.
Seriously?
Yeah, there's something about me that I had to get out. And I actually produced Godspell on Broadway, the first revival in 2011. So it was not a coincidence, I think. And then my parents dragged me to an audition when I was 5 years old and got me involved in the local theater. And that's where I always feel I found my family. You know, I was an only child, and I was a kid that just couldn't find other kids like him to hang out. And then I got to the theater, and then it was just like, wow, these people are like me. And a lot of theater people find that. I didn't look back for a while. Then I was 12. I got too cool for it. Thought I was going to play for the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Celtics simultaneously.
Oh, of course. Like a Bo Jackson sort of thing.
Exactly.
And what position?
I was going to play them all. I mean, what the heck, you know?
Oh, okay.
I then got re-bit by the bug when I saw Les Mis when I was in high school. And that's when I gave up the L.A. law dreams, as, you know, I was an 80s kid, and started pursuing the theater full time.
Well, you know, when your parents told you that, hey, theater's fine and everything, but you better have something to fall back on, they were pretty much, they meant that you should have like a law degree to fall back on. I think you may have gotten it mixed up that you were supposed to like maybe do theater, but like really you're going to be a lawyer as opposed to do law, but really you're going to be a theater producer.
I was very, very fortunate. In fact, my dad was an immigrant to this country. He came here in the 60s. He was born in India. He's part of the Indian doctor generation. Mm-hmm. And sadly, he just passed away over the weekend. And,
my sympathies.
It's okay. He was 90 years old, led a very full life. But as one of the few Indian doctors that used to say, don't be a doctor. I want you to pursue the theater if that's what you want.
That's amazing that he did that, especially as an immigrant, because that need to struggle and survive. That's full credit to him. That's you saw Les Mis. Was that on Broadway? Was that a touring production?
I saw it in Boston, the touring production, yeah.
Let me ask you this. You do this podcast, you do the blog. Has that actually helped you in your career? And if so, how? I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah, look, like, you know, it's just like I was saying about the live stream that I'm doing. You know, the things that have had the most impact on my life, whether that's professional, personal, or usually both, are the things that I do and don't think about if they're going to have an impact on my life. I do them because I want to do them. And then usually amazing things happen as a result. I can easily say starting the blog in 2008 was the single best thing I ever did for my career, and for a whole bunch of reasons. So now I'm a little, what's good about it now is it's happened so many times. And even when things don't work out, frankly, I've had shows that don't work out, and it's very easy for me to get over them because I always can say this: out of every single thing I do, something good always happens. Something. Now, some things may have more good things than others, but there's always something good. So yes, blogging, podcasting, which is really that age-old thing of how can you be of service to others, always comes back and helps.
Well, I wonder if you see any affinity with some of the old school producers, because I think of you sort of a little bit, not in the nefarious way, but like David Merrick, because you've been very innovative in how you promote your shows, in how you finance them, everything that you do in the positive sense. You've done things like Godspell. You invited some of the most passionate fans to sit in the audience and tweet during the show about their experience of Godspell, which, you know, sent some people's hair on fire. You started crowdfunding a Broadway show. I think you were the first one to do that. And Loft Broadway with Daddy Long Legs, the musical based on the beloved epistolary novel. You did a live stream of that show saying correctly, look, if anybody watches the live stream, they're going to be passionate fans of theater and they're not going to watch that and say, okay, I'm done. If they like it, they're going to want to see the show. They're not going to see it and go, okay, never mind, I'm done. So I think that all worked really well. And I thought it's fascinating. And you just did a live stream of Godspell. How did that go last night?
Well, last night wasn't actually a live stream of the show. I reunited the cast on.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes. Oh, I thought they were going to be performing it or singing songs by them. So you got everybody together for a cast reunion. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's been 9 years since they've done that show. I don't think we want to see them do some numbers. They'd need a little rehearsal.
So the live stream went well. It's just it was a fundraiser, right?
Yeah, we've been doing all these live streams as a fundraiser for the Actors Fund, this incredible organization that helps people from my industry during times like this.
whether you try a lot of different things to promote shows and to make them happen. Some things work better than others. Were you happy with how the crowdfunding went? Will you continue to do that on other shows, or does it depend on the show? Obviously, you wouldn't do that for Neil Diamond because people are lining up, I imagine, to fund that show.
Yeah, that one's a popular one already. But, it wasn't crowdfunding. Godspell wasn't about raising money. It was about raising a marketing army, actually. It was about getting publicity and press. And I also don't like to repeat myself. Mm-hmm. So when I come up with an interesting marketing angle I invited the town, getting the band back together, I invited the town where it was set. It was a real town in New Jersey. I invited the whole town to see it first. On my first time, which was about people's first sexual experience.
Invited virgins. Virgins get in for free.
That's right. So I would never repeat myself. I tend to try to challenge myself to come up with a new marketing angle every time.
And that's where I feel the spirit of David Merrick is looking over your shoulder and smiling.
Yeah, I just hope I'm not as much of an asshole as he is.
Right, exactly. That's why I didn't want to mention that too much. One thing that you did that's a dream of a lot of producers is you owned your own house. You had a off-Broadway theater, the Davenport, named after your grandfather, I think?
My great-grandfather, yep.
Yeah, that's awesome. You had that for 5 years. That had to be awesome. Was it heartbreaking to have it, to step away from it, or do you feel like you got everything out of it you could?
I like to try to do lots of different things, and running a building and having a place, an artistic home and somewhere where I could produce shows like Daddy Long Legs when I wanted to. And, that was fantastic. At the same time, I also learned that running a building is not really what I want to do. I don't want to worry about when you need to order more toilet paper. I mean, imagine what we'd be going through right now. It's I took my 5 years. It was a successful 5 years. I learned a lot, and I also learned I don't want to run a building. So I let them just run out. They actually didn't want it to be a theater anymore anyway. I let it run out, and I said, okay, now we go on to the new challenge, or just focusing on the other current challenges.
Well, you've got big Broadway shows we've talked about. You've got incredibly talented Tony winners that you have on your podcast and on your video casts during the pandemic. And those people, it's tough for everybody, but they're going to survive. But you also speak to a lot of people, dancers, actors, singers, people in the cabaret, just the people who are in the chorus and in the background. And those people, this time has to be so hard for them, because when there isn't work, which is a lot of the times for an actor, they waiter, they cater, and that's not happening either. So what are you hearing from them? It's got to be, that's why you're raising funds for all these different charities and groups to help them out. But what are you hearing from them? Are they feeling despair? Are they just chomping at the bit to get back to work? What's going on there?
Look, the interesting thing about this time is that everyone's in the same boat. You know, it's very hard to be like, oh, woe is me, because it's, oh, right, oh, woe is the world. Everyone is out of work. Everyone is at home. Everyone is going to struggle. There's not a person that this isn't going to touch, whether it's economically, whether it's health, whatever it is, we're going to feel it. So, and the theater people are optimistic, happy, passionate people. So they have those moments for sure, but everyone is also excited about, okay, how can we all come together? How can we help heal? And how can we be ready? I believe I'm about to do a webinar about this, and I've been talking about this a lot. I believe there are two types of people that will come out of this pandemic. There's the type of people that will come out of it exactly the way they went in. And then there will be type of people that come out of it smarter, stronger, and more prepared for whatever is next. And that's what you have to do and spend your time. I'm actually throwing a webinar this Thursday that said it's called How Theater Makers Should Make the Most of Their Quarantine. And it's about what we do during this period to help us make us smarter, stronger, and more prepared for the new world. It's going to be a new world. And I think this is a time where we can get ahead, not just stand still.
Well, that's, that the show will go on. Exactly, right? We should end with a song, but if you're not ready for that, we'll just say...
We have to rehearse.
thanks for taking the time to chat with us. We'll give links to all your stuff, your blog, your podcast, the Facebook page, and all the stuff you have going on, like Theater Makers Studio. And we look forward to maybe having back on when you got, Neil Diamond about to open up on Broadway. That's going to be very exciting. I know that will happen someday. It's going to be a long road, but you'll get there.
Yes, we will. Sooner than you think.
I'm sure. Well, thanks very much for your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that was very exciting to have someone like Ken Davenport on on the show. That was great. Thank you for arranging that, Michael.
He's a two-time Tony winner. That's pretty impressive. It's always great to, you know, have two of those little babies on your bookshelf. You know, when you do a live stream, you can casually put them in the background. Not that he's done that, but that's what I would do.
You know what I have on my bookshelf is press credentials from at least two CinemaCons, two Cannes, I've got like basically just a lot of press accreditations.
A lot of badges.
Yeah.
You're not carefully selecting the books that are viewable so that people can be impressed by your library, your eclectic and intellectual library offerings?
No. Although I have turned, and I was told, look, please stop lining yourself up against a blank wall.
It's really depressing.
Yeah. So I said, okay, fine. So I take my laptop now and I turn it around so that it's facing my desktop. And on my desktop, I put, you know, something interesting.
Like what we'll be looking at today?
By desktop, I mean my big, you know, desktop computer.
What would we be looking at today?
Today you'd be looking at all of the technical wizardry that it requires to record this podcast.
You should have like a movie poster, a classic film poster just hanging up behind you, you know, different one every time.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have a collection of film posters?
No, not at all.
I do have posters, but not film posters. Well, you don't have film posters, but you do have Big Deal, Big Whoop, don't you?
That's right. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is coronavirus, and actually it's also our last story. I'm just kidding. So here's the thing about France. What's French for fair use? That is one I'm learning French on Duolingo. Yeah, they haven't gotten to the fair use chapter yet, so I have no idea how to say fair use.
You should have made your Cannes Film Festival joke. They said we can't have big, large gatherings, and you said,
I told Stephen Garrett, who I often attend the festival with and stay with during the festival, I said, I am immediately writing to the president of the Cannes Film Festival to tell him that I have always said that the Cannes Film Festival was an intimate gathering.
I thought it was a good one. So what else is happening in France?
Well, in France, the courts have ruled against Google, and Google being, you know, the search engine. The search engine giant must pay media companies for accessing news stories in their searches. Google has been including excerpts from those stories in its search results, and the courts have ruled that Google must pay for displaying that content. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. There's been a lot of talk that these companies, Facebook and Google and others, should be paying for the content that they're profiting from. In this case, they were including brief excerpts from the news stories in their searches. What it turns out might happen is that they'll just end that practice. They'll have blankers.
They did in Spain, by the way. When you go to Spain,
yeah,
you cannot get Google News there. They said, oh, you know what? If you're going to charge us for that, here, hold on a second. Okay, now refresh your page. Okay, try to find Google News on Google now. Oh, you can't, can you? Well, that's why.
Yeah, so they may be biting the hand that feeds them, but we'll see.
And of course, everybody in Spain went, oh my God, all of our traffic dropped off a cliff. No, please bring it back. And so, of course, all of the news outlets said, we were just kidding. We were just kidding. Please don't go away. And that's really the problem is
Google has them over a barrel.
Right.
It's not that they're wrong. It's that Google has, you know, gotten them into a position where they depend on it so much, they can't afford to let it get away.
Right. And France is saying, hey, you know what? The only thing people read are the headlines. So they're only reading the headlines and the two little excerpts, two sentence excerpt that you have on Google. They're not actually clicking through. But the media outlets are saying, well, actually, no, we get a lot of traffic from Google. So what's true? Are they directing traffic to Google or are people just reading the headlines on Google?
Well, the truth is that Google is profiting either way.
Yeah, I don't know that they have ads on the actual Google News site, although they do track people. So I guess they know what they're looking at, right? I mean, they know what their users are looking at. And
they don't do anything that they don't profit from.
That's true. You know, here's the thing. If you do not know what the product is usually you. Is Jeffrey Katzenberg right, by the way? He's been touting the new platform Quibi, a name that I believe, Michael, both you and I made fun of. Mm-hmm. He's been saying that Quibi will be a purveyor of bite-sized entertainment that people can watch on their phones. With the entire world shut in their homes, this was either the best or the worst time to launch the app. Indeed, they announced the app was downloaded more than 1.7 million times, above their expectations. People who did so get a 90-day free trial. After that, they'll pay $5 a month for access with ads or $8 a month for an ad-free experience. Why would you pay for something with ads? Yikes. Big deal or big whoop?
It's called cable TV. People pay for stuff with ads all the time. They go to movie. They pay to see a movie, and then they watch trailers and commercials while they sit there waiting for the movie to begin. It happens all the time. I think this is a big whoop. We'll have to see how many people stay on after 90 days. Obviously, they wanted to tout some good numbers. Their first day downloads were pretty weak. Then they got it up to 1.7 million for the first week. So that's better. Is it what they wanted? They say it was, but you know, will they stick around? That's where the truth will be told. So the jury is still out. You don't want to make fun of them. And indeed, we made fun of Quibi. We also made fun of the name Google. So what do we know?
And we made fun of the name Hulu. We thought, oh, that's a horrible name. It'll never amount to anything except for a few Emmys for best drama. Hollywood studios have been pushing to collapse Windows for years now. We've talked about it all the time, Michael. They don't want to wait, and this is studios, don't want to wait 12 weeks before making new movies available to consumers in their home. Hollywood wants to push for premium video on demand, offering titles for $20 or more for rental mere weeks after the film has opened in theaters. Well, now they got their wish. Universal just scotched plans for a theatrical release for the animated sequel Trolls World Tour and rushed it into VOD this past weekend. And Fandango now just declared the fuzzy-haired film a hit, scoring the biggest pre-order total and biggest first three-day rental orders in the company's history. However, that could be five. Anyway, the previous record holder for three-day rentals at Fandango now, what was it? The Invisible Man. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, isn't it? First of all, we don't know what it actually did. Secondly, it beat a record that was set a few days ago, which doesn't mean The Invisible Man did so great so much as that Fandango now is not where a lot of people go to rent films. I know they've been around a while, but still, who goes to Fandango now to rent films? But Fandango now is owned by Comcast, which also owns Universal, which also owns Trolls World Tour. So it's one big happy family. So
until you just literally hit the nail on the head.
Yep.
Why that story is a story in the first place.
And that is?
The vertical integration.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a big, and frankly, even if it works, it won't tell us a lot because we're in such unusual times. Studios really want to see what happens if they put a movie day and date via theatrical or say 2 or 4 weeks after theatrical. I don't know what their rush is. 12 weeks is really, really fast, I think, for most movies, but it's going to happen someday and we'll get a real world experiment. In this case, I don't think you can draw any conclusions.
I agree with you. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into actually not inside baseball. We're not doing inside baseball because, you know, not a whole heck of a lot is going on.
Well, Ken Davenport was sort of inside baseball. He's an industry player, far more important than we are. He knows what's going on in the business. He's done a lot of interesting stuff, and he gave us that inside baseball-y insight.
Hey, speak for yourself.
What?
That could apply literally to anything you just said.
Okay.
Okay. But we do have some sad news. Some people died this past week, including Mort Drucker.
That's right. He's an illustrator who parodied films and TV shows for Mad Magazine. He died at 91. And I thought, oh, I don't know. You know what? A lot of Hollywood people love this guy. He really became a rite of passage for celebrities. In fact, there was a quote, Johnny Carson asked Michael J. Fox of Back to the Future, when did he know he'd made it? And Fox said, when Mort Drucker drew my head. You know, they did all those parodies, like Star Wars became Star Bores, and they did a parody of Bonanza with the Cartwright family sitting in a bath together. Charlie's Angels, Happy Days. If you ever got on the pop cultural radar, Mad Magazine would make fun of you. In fact, lawyers for George Lucas once sent a cease and desist order to Mad after it parodied The Empire Strike Back. They were saying, hey, you can't use that. That's our material. They demanded they burn every copy of the magazine, destroy the plates, salt the land, give them their children. At the same time, George Lucas had sent them a gushing fan letter praising what they had done. So they sent a copy of the George Lucas letter back to his own lawyers and said, gee, he seems to like it. And they never heard from them again.
You know, that's one of those things where, like, you know, lawyers, they have to do that to, like, you know, kind of honor the trademark. And then they say, well, we did that. We did do that. And if we don't get back to them, then it's our, you know, it's our choice, but we did actually, you know, defend the copyright.
That's right.
Now, this probably was the biggest news over the last week, and that is the death of John Prine, musician and songwriter John Prine.
That's right. He's a beloved songwriter, widely covered, a Grammy winner, owned his own record label, sort of a trailblazer in that path. You know, he's in the Americana folky vein, and from his classic debut in 1971 to his highest charting album of his career, Thank You SoundScan, that happened in 2018. He's had a pretty acclaimed, if low-key, career. A lot of people probably haven't heard of him, but he's beloved among, you know, he's the songwriter's songwriter, that sort of the guy. And here's something I really didn't know. Film critic Roger Ebert. When I would go to Ebert Fest and hear all these filmmakers talking about how, you know, he wrote them a note when they were starting the first day on filming their first film because friends asked him to. And he was encouraging to nobodies. And he was encouraging to people who made short films. And he was encouraging to Werner Herzog when his career was in the dumps. And Roger Ebert kept paying attention to all his work and giving him that visibility and belief in himself and how much it meant to all of them. It wasn't just in movies. Roger Ebert walked into a bar, stumbled on John Prine doing a set and said, "This guy's great." And he raved about it in the Chicago newspapers, and that helped kickstart his career. He was a mailman turned songwriter. That was his day job, delivered the mail, one of our essential servers, and Ebert just stumbled on upon him and just raved about him, and it went on from there.
Like you, I had no idea that that was how John Prine kind of got launched.
Well, that was certainly a big part of it, you know, and you said that John Prine was the big news for people. For me, it was a music impresario, Hal Willner. I love this guy. He died at 64. Sadly, just like John Prine, it was due to complications from coronavirus. He's a longtime music supervisor for SNL. So if you watch their live streaming show that they did this week, you saw a little tribute to Hal Willner. He's the guy who would score the skits that needed music to be underneath them. He's been doing that for decades. He's also produced albums by Marianne Faithfull, Bill Frisell, William Burroughs, Laurie Anderson, and Lou Reed, her husband, who became a lifelong friend of Hal Willner. He brought Jeff Buckley to an event in New York honoring Jeff's dad, Tim Buckley. That was way back in 1991. That helped launch Jeff's career. Everybody went, oh my God, Tim Buckley's kid is hugely talented. And here's what he's really known for. This is very few people can say they invented a genre or a style or some sort of approach to things. You know, Brian Eno invented the ambient music world. Hal Willner really perfected, if he didn't completely invent, the tribute album. People before him had done, you know, Ella Fitzgerald would say, here's a tribute album to Gershwin. Frank Sinatra would record a tribute album to Cole Porter. Not that he actually ever did that, but they would record albums to great songwriters or people or whatever. Hal Willner came up with the idea of the all-star tribute album, and he made it an art form. He began in 1980 with the crazy idea of saying, hey, let's do an all-star jazz tribute album to the songs from Fellini films by Nina Rota. Apparently, no one has done this before, he said excitedly. He got Blondie and Wynton Marsalis and all sorts of unexpected people to appear on the album Amarcord Nino Rota. More tribute albums followed: Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, Kurt Vile, Harold Arlen, Leonard Cohen. Two albums of music linked to pirates called Rogues Gallery, and perhaps most famously, a tribute to songs from the classics Disney films called Stay Awake. That was just great. He even did lots of tribute concerts, like I saw a Bill Withers tribute he did in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. He's got a final tribute album coming out soon. It's for Mark Bolan and T-Rex, featuring Nick Cave, Kesha, Joan Jett, and all sorts of the eclectic people you can imagine. The guy, if you've seen any tribute album to any artist you'd like in the last 30 years, the reason for that is Hal Willner. He really made that baby happen. So tribute albums to Los Lobos, Richard Thompson, whatever it was, Hal Willner's the guy that started all of that. He's a crazily interesting guy. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. And I'm really going to miss him a lot.
Well, I thought Ken Davenport was a crazily interesting guy, or whatever the adjectives you were throwing around there were. And I'm thankful that he joined us on today's show.
Absolutely. And people can join us online, can't they?
Yes, they can. Well, they can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, you can rate and review us, you can subscribe to us. You can find those links on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T @showbizsandbox.com. or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is at Showbiz Sandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's whydidn'titinterviewdrakewhenihadthechance.com. Why is that? I could have interviewed him when he was on Degrassi, The Next Generation. But just as we go to press right now, his new song, Toosie Slide, I don't know if I'm saying that right, that debuted at number one on Billboard's charts. He's got a tie with Aretha Franklin and Stevie Wonder for the most number ones of all time on the R&B charts. That's pretty amazing.
Well, I don't know about that website, but if you want to, you know, catch up with some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, then head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.